This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie, brought to you by Killer Podcasts, an Evergreen Podcasts network. I'm the titular Sean.
And I'm the very titular Carrie.
It's the show that takes you inside the unbelievable, the unexplainable, the macabre, and the bizarre and tries to find an answer. And that, Caroline, is Robert Johnson.
Yes, yes. Now, I understand that the clip sounds very old and scratchy, and I'm sure his voice sounds higher pitched than it was in real life, just because this is from the 30s. But if you don't recognize the name Robert Johnson at first listen, chances are you have enjoyed music heavily influenced by his work.
Well, sure, yeah, all rock and R&B and therefore pop music, Carrie.
Have you heard of Robert Johnson, Sean?
Yes, of course. I can't say I'm super familiar with old-time blues music.
No?
But I do know that Robert Johnson supposedly sold his soul to the devil to be able to play the guitar real well. Mm-hmm. And there's a character in Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou who's clearly based on this figure. But yeah, that selling his soul to the devil thing's basically all I know about him.
Yeah, well, Robert Johnson was and still is a legend of American blues. He's kind of considered the first official, so to speak, member of the 27 Club. And he was one of the first major figures to influence the genre of rock and roll music.
The guy we just heard was less than 27 years old?
He was 27. People sounded different back then. Had a lot more living in those years, I think.
Yeah, I guess.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame refers to Robert Johnson as the first ever rock star. He's kind of the founding father of rock, in a way. Major musicians like Bob Dylan, Keith Richards, and Robert Plant have named Johnson as one of the key influences on their work. And Eric Clapton himself called him the most important blues singer that ever lived. But little is known for sure about Johnson's life, and much of his influence stems from a mere couple dozen recordings made in 1936 and 37, one of which you just heard a clip from. Before he died very unexpectedly at the age of, obviously, 27 in 1938.
So this is a story of like a white-hot rise to flame or to fame, and then the just as fast flaming out, like we've seen repeated so many times after.
Yeah, I mean, the classic, it's better to burn out than to fade away, which is a quote from another 27 Club member, Kurt Cobain. But yes, it's sort of this very unexpected halting of a rise in people knowing who this person is and people seeking him out to listen to him perform.
You know, I do think if Kurt had made it to the fading away stage, I think he would find it very comfortable.
Yeah, it's sad what he went through. He was obviously struggling with a lot. Obviously, there are conspiracy theories regarding him and many of the other members of the 27 Club. And we'll talk about that a little bit later and then more in a future episode, I think. But yeah, so I've talked before about how I'm really interested in the history of music, especially rock and roll, just because I think that genre in particular is such a sort of a temperature gauge of American culture, especially with the rise and the different trends and everything. It really tends to closely follow what's relevant in popular culture and what's relevant politically. Mm-hmm. And Robert Johnson, I mean, you can't talk about the history of American music without talking about him. But how did he exert so much impact on that history of music in such a short span of time with such a relatively small legacy left behind of just a few recordings?
Oh, well, I already told you, Carrie, he was a warlock.
Well, Sean, perhaps part of the interest is that old Robert has a very particular, very famous legend attached to his name that he sold his soul to the devil at a local crossroads to achieve his musical success. So where did this legend come from? Why was it attached to him? Is there any truth to it? Did he spread this rumor about himself?
Is there any truth to it?
Well, any truth to it, at least, you know, from his own mouth. Like, did he say that? Even if he was lying, blues musicians would kind of say things about themselves all the time to sort of build a mystique and a story.
Well, I know he has a song called The Crossroad Blues. Is that not about going to the crossroad and selling his soul to the devil?
Weirdly, it's not, Sean. It's about going to the crossroad.
Well, that's...
But he's doing other stuff there.
Yeah, I can only say I'm surprised.
But the first one that we listened to a clip from, and we'll talk about it a little more later, is Hellhound on My Trail.
Yeah,
and
I heard him say it a couple times.
A little more explicitly about being followed by a dark entity of sorts. Now, whether that's emotional or literal, who's to say? But to try and explain where this legend came from and if there's anything to it, we have to go back to the early 1900s, to the Mississippi Delta and the very beginnings of American blues, at least in the sense of recording and becoming, you know, more popularly known.
Right, because the form has been developing from slave spirituals, right?
Exactly, yes. Combined with, you know, folk music that was developed in the South and West. But yeah, you can't have the blues without having the legacy of slavery in there. So there's obviously a lot to talk about. But we're going to start in Mississippi in the early 1900s. Robert Johnson was born in Hazelhurst, Mississippi, possibly on May 8th, 1911, to Julia Major Dodds and a farm worker named Noah Johnson. Now, Robert was the result of an extramarital affair between Julia and Noah. Mm. Julia's actual husband, Charles Dodds, had earlier been forced by a lynch mob to leave the area following a dispute he had with some white landowners, so he had fled town. And Julia was left all alone. And
stepping out with another lady's man.
Yeah, I couldn't tell exactly if Noah was married, but I assume he was. He wasn't much of a presence in the baby's life. Soon after baby Robert's birth, Julia left Hazelhurst with him, eventually moving with Robert to Memphis to live with Charles Dodds, who she was still married to, and who had changed his name to Charles Spencer. Apparently, Charles was understanding when his wife showed up with some other guy's baby, because the family lived together in Memphis for the next 8 to 9 years.
Now, obviously, recording music isn't a thing yet, so Memphis is mainly known for just racism at this point? Or?
No, I mean, well, yes, but also... In Memphis, young Robert Johnson sort of discovered his love for blues music because it was a very popular thing to perform live. And this love would end up becoming the defining one of his life. It reminds me of like the beginning of the Elvis movie, you know, where he's kind of going around, what's that great music playing? You know, it's very much that.
When he goes to like the gospel meeting?
Yeah, and then is he actually in Memphis when he sees like he meets Little Richard and it's like, oh, he's there.
Yes, I think they are hanging out in Memphis.
Yes. It seems that Charles Spencer died sometime in the 19-teens because Julia would remarry around 1919 to a sharecropper named Will Dusty Willis, moving to the town of Commerce in the Mississippi Delta, and soon Robert would join them there. And he was still school-aged, so he was kind of bopping around from school to school. But he was in school, which not every young boy, poor kid in the South would be, and certainly not every young black child would be in the South. Robert was fairly well educated for a man of his, young man of his ethnicity and poor background, and that could have helped him in his musicianship later on.
I remember we talked in our Man from the Train episode, our axe murder extravaganza of last year, about just how low the literacy rate was throughout the South for white and black kids, but black kids especially in the early 20th century.
And Robert, at times, he was attending what were called colored schools. These were segregated just for African-American children. But he was attending school, which a lot of kids would drop out. A lot of kids would spend their time on the farm or actually working at this point. So he spent most of his young life in school, which is different for this time period. At some point, he began to pick up instruments to learn them. Willie Coffey, an old school friend, was interviewed later in life about Johnson, and he said that even in school, Robert was already known for playing harmonica and jaw harp. Don't you have a jaw harp?
A Jew's harp? I do.
Oh, Sean, that feels weird.
I don't know. It's just what it's called. It's also called a jaw harp.
Okay. Is that the one that goes like bow, bow, bow,
bow? Yeah, yeah, you hate it. It's like wow, 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 wow. It's a little, just a little metal thing you put on your teeth and try not to crack your teeth as you strum it.
Yeah, be careful with that.
Wow, 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 wow. I can go get it. Should I go get it?
You know what? I think we've kind of represented it here. At some point around this time, Julia informed Robert that his real father was her bygone lover, Noah Johnson. It seems like because he was so young when they moved back to be with Charles Dodds, he just thought that Charles was his father his whole life. And this revelation prompted Robert to adopt the surname of Johnson after his birth father. And also around this time, Robert married 14-year-old... different times, people. Virginia Travis in February of 1929, but she would sadly die in childbirth shortly after, and the baby also tragically passed with her.
You know, you had intimated, Carrie, that we might be talking about Edgar Allan Poe again this week, and I'm just glad
I'm going to get there, but...
I'm just glad we still got to marrying some teenagers in here.
Yeah, and her name's Virginia, too. If she was a cousin, it would be the trifecta. In interviews with blues researcher Robert Mac McCormick, surviving relatives of Virginia's said that they believed her death was divine punishment for Robert's decision to sing secular songs, in a way selling his soul to the devil. And McCormick concluded that Johnson himself kind of accepted or at least embraced this idea. Maybe it added to his sort of dark mystique.
But also like kind of a... I mean, probably it was this symbolic of a greater, like, kind of shedding of his. Well, I'm gonna take the music with me, but I'm not gonna.
He does that a little more later on, but I think this is kind of the first time where, because he had left home, she was pregnant, she stayed back with her family to give birth, and he had left to go make some money, and he was trying to do so playing music, and we'll see why that is. Wasn't really a great avenue for him at the time. And he came back and her and the baby were gone.
The answer, by the way, is because no one just wants to hear you stand there and play a jaw harp for 2 hours. No one else.
Well, no, he wasn't good, but we'll talk about that. But so he comes back and his wife and baby are dead. And now he is not married and he doesn't have these same responsibilities anymore. And so he starts to take the opportunity to become more serious about performing and traveling around to perform at this point. Around this time, blues musician Son House moved to Robinsonville, where Robert was living, to work and perform with his musical partner, Willie Brown. These are both big names in old-timey American blues. And these future blues legends would politely allow, at least initially, Robert to sit in and play with them sometimes as they performed on the Roadhouse circuit, but would say later that initially they were really unimpressed with his musicianship, and after a while would even try to avoid him because they saw him as such like a wannabe, and he didn't have any of the necessary talent to back up his goals, basically.
That's brutal. So Robert Johnson comes up the streets, oh hey guys, and they're like,
yeah,
they're ducking into a nearby doorway
because he's apparently, according to literally everyone interviewed who knew him at the time, Robert was really mediocre. He had a lot of passion. He really wanted to be a good musician, but he just was not at this point. House said in an interview included in the 1997 documentary Can't You Hear the Wind Howl that audiences couldn't stand Johnson's guitar playing at this point. Quote, folks, they come and say, why don't you go out and make that boy put that thing down, meaning the guitar. He's running us crazy. Finally, he left. He ran off from his mother and father and went over in Arkansas someplace or other. So basically, feeling the freeze, Robert disappeared from the Robinsonville area for the next 6 to 18 months.
You know, it's interesting. There's not like a blueprint for becoming a, you know, a traveling blues musician at this point.
Sure.
It doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
There's no blueprint for being a pop star or a rock star because mm-hmm. those things don't exist.
He's basically looking to people like Son House and Willie Brown as his mentors. And they're like, you're so far gone. You are such a lost cause that we can't even be around you because the audiences literally can't stand to hear you play.
It reminds me of, because in stand-up comedy, everyone's bad when they start.
Sure.
You know, and everybody just goes and is bad at open mics for a year or two
mm-hmm.
or more before they start developing chops. But they're all really excited to be there because that's why they're there. They're not getting paid. So he's an open mic comic.
Pretty much. And so, you know, Robert's sort of sensing that they're not picking up what he's putting down, and he is likely very disappointed in his own abilities at this point. So he just disappears for either as little as 6 months or as much as 18 months. But he disappears from the Robinsonville area, and no one knows where he went at this time, at least the people that he had been performing with and stuff back in Robinsonville. And it's this time period that many relate directly to the legend of Johnson selling his soul to the devil for musical talent.
Okay, so there is going to be a little more meat on this bone. Because I was already kind of satisfied by just like if his preacher was like, you're selling your soul playing the devil's music.
Well, we'll discuss that legend in detail after the break.
Oh!
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get $6,000 cash, give us each $3,000, we give you this.
Uh-huh.
You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com. or wherever fine podcasts are found.
And we're back. When last we left you, we heard it's a mixed bag, the early life of Robert Johnson. He probably gets, he has a mom who seems to care about him. He probably mm-hmm. gets more opportunities than a lot of people in his position in very early life.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's dealt a tough hand with this young teenage wife dying.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just not very good at the guitar, is he, Carrie?
He's not.
But that leads us to, you had brought us to a pivotal moment in the story.
Mm-hmm.
This is the point at which Robert Johnson is going to sell his soul to Lucifer, the Morning Star.
Allegedly. Now, the story of a man selling his soul to Satan at a crossroads to receive some kind of reward in life, though also a tormented afterlife, far preceded Robert Johnson. So even as early as Johnson's operating, this has been around for ages. In the book Take a Walk on the Dark Side, Rock and Roll Myths, Legends, and Curses by R. Gary Patterson, the author describes it as follows, quote, "The use of the crossroads as a symbol of Satan's presence comes from the concept of being the final resting place for suicides and those unworthy of being buried in hallowed ground. Crossroads were also supposed to be the site where witches held their gatherings. Many readers familiar with the works of Nathaniel Hawthorne will remember that his character, young Goodman Brown, from the short story of the same name, keeps his appointment with the devil at a crossroads." You love Nathaniel, don't you, Sean?
Oh, one of my apps. Yeah, you know, one of my absolute favorites.
It's like you with Dickens. I just don't get it. I like Nathaniel, though. I like young Goodman Brown in particular, but it's witchy, so.
Well, it's short anyway, so.
Wow. We've referenced this fact before, but just to remind all of you, Hawthorne knew all about witchiness. It was his ancestor, John Hathorne, that had sat as one of the judges in the Salem witch trials, helping send many innocents to their deaths for the crime of consorting with Satan. We talked a lot about that, I don't know, a year and a half ago?
Yeah, Cat's butt was involved. Let's not go back there.
Little pea cake.
Yeah, pea cakes, absolutely.
Yeah. There's also the classic story of Faust, where the titular character makes a pact with the devil at the crossroads, exchanging his soul for unlimited knowledge and worldly pleasures. This was kind of the typical exchange made in these kinds of legends. For an afterlife spent in hell, but you don't have to worry about that till later, you know? The soul giver would receive whatever he asked for in life in this pact. This would be known as a Faustian bargain, sacrificing spiritual values for power, knowledge, or material gain. Robert Johnson wasn't even the first bluesman to have been rumored to sell his soul to the devil. An earlier musician, Tommy Johnson, no relation, also had a similar story.
That's the name of the guitarist in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Now, according to Tommy Johnson's brother, Liddell, Tommy claimed himself to have sold his soul to Satan at a crossroads in exchange for his mastery of the guitar. And I think even less is known about Tommy's full life, which is why this legend is more attributed to Robert Johnson. And it was even, you know, during or near Robert Johnson's lifetime. But I think he's just such a pivotal figure. And there's this really interesting dichotomy between his like bad musicianship in the early life, and then he just comes back and he's like much better, which we'll talk about later. And it's so this sort of like miraculous change that I think makes it more of a, you know, a long-lasting legend for Robert than for Tommy. But Liddell gave a description of the supposed event to author Francis Davis in his book, The History of the Blues. Quote, "If you want to learn to play anything you want to play and learn how to make songs yourself, you take your guitar and you go to where a crossroads is. A big black man will walk up there at the stroke of midnight and take your guitar and he'll tune it. And pretty much after he tunes it, it's like magic. You just suddenly become really, really great at guitar." For clarity's sake, Liddell may not have meant a big black man in like an ethnic sense, rather, and especially in the early colonial era, you'll see this in Salem witch trials documents, the devil was all often referred to as black, like, but this might have been more of like a vibe or a shadowy thing rather than a reference to the color of skin, though it could have been that because they were racist and, you know, they had slaves still at that point, so who knows?
For sure. Or he could have been covered in black fur.
I mean, yes. You know. Or soot, because he's from hell.
Made of smoke.
Yes. And for those film buffs among us, Sean, you did mention you might recognize this specific version of the story because it was referenced in the film Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? When Everett, Pete, and Delmar pick up a man at a deserted crossroads, he introduces himself as Tommy Johnson and tells the men that he had just sold his soul to the devil, leading right into the recording of the group's admitted bop, I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow, which Tommy plays on the recording of.
The Soggy Bottom Boys, of course.
Mm-hmm. But how did Robert become associated with the legend? The major turning point, as I mentioned earlier, seems to be this unaccounted for 6 to 18 months when he disappeared from his usual circuit.
Okay. All right. Hold on. So you're going to tell me he disappeared for between a half a year and a year and a half?
Yes.
And when he came back, no one knows what he's been doing.
Yes.
But he's really good at guitar.
Yes.
I have a feeling about what he might have been doing for 18 months.
Importantly, when Robert left Robinsonville, he was such a mediocre blues musician that local performers were literally trying to avoid him so they didn't have to feel obligated to let him play with them, even as like a pity thing. But when he came back, he was an absolute virtuoso. Particularly, he seemed to have completely mastered the guitar and the blues sound in the short time he was gone without any explanation. And he didn't even seem to have given details as to how he got so good.
Because all he did was play for 8 hours a day for 18 months.
Well, it was said by some that Robert had learned these newfound abilities with the guitar, at least, from blues musician Isaiah Ike Zimmerman, who he'd met at one of Zimmerman's performances around 1931 at a local juke joint in Beauregard, Mississippi. This is close to where Robert had been born, in Hazelhurst, and so this fact leads many to believe that Robert had gone looking for his birth father, Noah Johnson, after being told by Julia that his true parentage was not as he had thought all of his life. And then along this sort of journey to understanding of himself, he ran into Zimmerman.
And he said, "You're my dad now."
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, definitely a major figure in his story. And Zimmerman himself had this spooky sort of mystique. It was rumored that he had learned to play guitar as well as he did supernaturally by visiting graveyards at night with the instrument and playing among the tombstones. Of course, that doesn't exactly give the details as to how playing a guitar in a graveyard will help you become a blues legend. Because I'll do that. I'll do it right now.
Maybe like if any of the dead people are guitarists, sure, they'll come out and jam with you. There's no better way to, any musician will tell you, if you're jamming with other musicians is how you get better.
Right. Well, it was said that Robert would join Ike on midnight jaunts to Beauregard Cemetery, as well as other burying grounds, and that is where the men would practice together, sitting on the tombstones with no crowd to complain about the noise, which was probably particularly useful in Robert's case, because when he left, the crowds were literally begging the other musicians to take him off the stage. When Johnson returned to the Robinsonville area, Sunhouse, Willie Brown, and all the musicians that had previously given him the cold shoulder were stunned by his miraculous change in abilities. And to them, however long he was actually gone, it didn't account, the timing didn't account for how much he had improved. So he must have really sucked and then really became like an expert.
Right.
The definitive story would end up stemming from Sun House, telling historian Pete Welding later in life, quote, "He sold his soul to the devil to get to play like that." And to House, it was really, as he presented it, the only plausible explanation for how Johnson had become such a virtuoso in months. Quote, "When that boy started playing and when he got through, all of our mouths were hanging open. All. He was gone." So pretty much like he was just totally leagues above where he had been.
I'm dead.
Mm-hmm. I'm out of here. This was Sunhouse recalling the first time the musicians heard him play when he returned to Robinsonville. So it was just such a huge drastic shift. In the Netflix documentary Remastered, Devil at the Crossroads, researchers wondered at how Johnson was able to achieve his signature sound that he ended up displaying after this mysterious time away. Because to them, it almost sounded like a whole band was playing, or like multiple instruments. But the only instrument and the only person playing was Johnson on his old sixth string, which he had rigged to be a seventh string. Now, I don't really know much about strings, but that seems interesting that he had made this guitar seven strings for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to rig some kind of a tuning peg up onto the head to drill another hole through your stock and run the string through your bridge and run a string through there.
String through the bridge, yeah.
And then you'd have to tune it probably to one of the other strings.
Or the devil tuned it.
Sure, you have the devil tune it, yes, to one of the other strings, probably? I don't know.
Maybe it would create some kind of echo, but that's only for one of the strings, I guess, so it's interesting. Sometime on his journey, Johnson also fathered a child with a woman named Virgie Mae Smith, and on his return to town, he married another woman, Coletta Craft, in May 1931. The couple lived for a time in Clarksdale, Mississippi, starting in 1932. However, Johnson would soon leave, rejuvenated by his sudden expertise, to become a traveling musician, and Coletta died in early 1933.
Unlucky in love.
Yeah, and that's another thing that people bring up, is that he, despite having certain advantages, not necessarily advantages, but again, he was educated, he had a caring family, as far as we know. These were things that not everyone in his situation benefited from at the time. But he experienced a lot of tragedy, especially with his love life. Mm-hmm. And like the woman that he had gotten pregnant, her family was very religious. It was out of wedlock, so they were just forbidden to be together. Even if he had wanted to marry her, he wasn't allowed to. And so when Coletta died, he never married again, but he kind of became a sort of romantic nomad. He would...
You mean a fuckboy?
Well, he on his travels, he would often stay with lady friends for extended periods of time, and these would often be romantic entanglements. So he's a bit of a fuckboy.
Okay. All right, just confirming.
From 1932 until his death in 1938, Robert Johnson played the circuit between the cities of Memphis, Tennessee and Helena, Arkansas, including small towns in the Mississippi Delta and neighboring Mississippi and Arkansas regions. And at times he would even travel much further, including performances in Chicago, New York, Canada, and more. One guy who was getting together a massive performance of like all the big names basically at the time, I think in New York, it was called something like From Spirituals to Swing or something like that, was trying desperately to find Robert Johnson because he had heard of him all the way from the East Coast, but he had already died. So,
wow.
Yeah. But he was becoming known, even though fame was very different back then. News traveling and especially entertainment traveling was very different back then. People were starting to hear of this man who could play like a whole band.
And is he like 25, 26 at this point?
Yes, yes. Some people would say that he would turn his back on the audience while he played so they couldn't see how he made his guitar sound the way it did.
Sure, the magic trick. You got to protect your secrets.
Mm-hmm. Around 1936, he endeavored to make some actual recordings of his songs, now that that was becoming at least a little easier by the end of the year.
These are a wax cylinder?
I think these are very, very early records. I mean, probably some cylinders, but I saw images at least of like the first pressings of these records, which did really well. I think his first single, so to speak, sold like 10,000 copies, which is... I mean, it's bigger than Polka, Polka, Polka or whatever John Candy was playing.
Kiss Me Polka?
Yes. Polka Twist. By the end of the year, he had committed 16 pieces to record, including eventual blues standards, I Believe I'll Dust My Broom.
that is a wedding classic. A yes. Wedding playlist isn't ready without Gotta Dust My Broom.
Mm-hmm. Sweet Home Chicago and the intriguingly named Crossroad Blues. Here's a selection from the latter.
I went to the crossroad, fell down on my knees. I went to the crossroad, fell down on my knees.
So I don't know if I hear the guitar thing you're talking about, where it sounds like, well, how is he making all those sounds?
You know, that was something that like professional musicians and stuff have talked about. So I just sort of went with it.
Yeah, I'm very much
they know better than me.
Yeah, I'm very much not a professional musician. So
yeah, I mean, I do hear kind of some doubling of notes, but I don't know how normal that is on a guitar anyway, because I play my little ukulele and that's all I do.
It's got four strings.
It's small.
It is. Yeah.
Now, interestingly, Crossroad Blues doesn't contain any actual references to some sort of Faustian bargain or the devil. It does talk about the crossroads, but he's kind of like talking about a lady, mostly.
So he's at the crossroads like, well, do I fuck or do I not fuck? I'm Robert Johnson. I'm gonna fuck.
But Johnson would record two songs at his later session that would reflect on those themes. Hellhound on My Trail, which we heard at the top of the show.
But we can agree that's a pretty flexible metaphor.
Mm-hmm. And Me and the Devil Blues. In the former, Johnson sings of trying to escape a hellhound on his trail. It's a likely reference to common imagery in Southern churches at the time, apparently, where they talked a lot about hellhounds running down and catching sinners. It might have also been sort of a veiled metaphor about lynching, because a lot of, unfortunately, African-American people who were lynched or sort of set upon by town mobs, they had dogs put on them and things like that. So maybe the hellhound was sort of like a hellish hound instead of a hound from hell.
Also, going back to, I don't know if I'm grasping at straws here, but going back to slavery and to the sort of Negro spiritual roots of this mm-hmm. music, you know, wade in the water, and still wade in the water, God's going to trouble the water, is because the dogs that would be after you aren't going to smell the water, right? Although it's certainly a literal reference to Moses. But
right.
But anyway, my point is,
it's a double reference, which might be going on in this song.
And Hounds on Your Trail, yeah, that could also be hearkening back all the way to that time. Although, as you point out, certainly people were still being tracked through the South with dogs in the early 1900s.
Yeah, and it speaks to sort of a existential dread, this sort of original sin of America, right? That is following behind. I mean, at this point, Robert Johnson is singing within less than a century after the end of the Civil War. He's born less than 50 years after the end of the Civil War, you know? So it's all very, very fresh. And he might feel like he has a hellhound on his trail, which is just this curse of his background. In Me and the Devil Blues, Johnson very interestingly tells the story of the song's POV character waking up one morning to find the devil knocking on his door, telling him it's time to go. So perhaps this is referencing a man who has sold his soul and is now expected to return to hell with Satan to fulfill his part of the Faustian pact. The lyrics conclude with the lines, "You may bury my body down by the highway side so my old evil spirit can catch a greyhound bus and ride." And again, as we mentioned earlier, suicides and others that weren't allowed to be buried on Christian burial grounds were often buried at crossroads. So that's kind of like a, you know, by the highway side sort of thing, might be a reference to that.
Crossroads have always been considered kind of spooky too. Mm-hmm. The Romans had, I mean, they had a god for everything, but there was a goddess of crossroads and she was kind of spooky and, related to magic, and fortune tellers and witches would sit up there. And it's also where you'd have political debates, which is the scariest thing of all.
Oh, especially nowadays, right? Am I right? Yeah. I mean, there, ancient Roman times, you have the old ye olde witchcraft times reference crossroads. And even, you know, I didn't get too deep into this because it's sort of like a whole other like religious topic, but Papa Legba, the voodoo or hoodoo god associated often with death in the culture, is said to also be like associated with crossroads or the god of the crossroads, things like that. Again, I didn't get too deep into that because, you know, that's like a whole other separate thing. But it sort of ties into the idea of this the old spirituals and how those often mixed via metaphor or whatever, the new sort of Christianity that had been imposed on slaves that had been brought to this country and the remnants of the religions that they brought with them from Africa. So perhaps Robert Johnson did go with the devil when he answered the door, because Me and the Devil Blues was recorded at Johnson's final session in June of 1937. And I think there was only like two major recording sessions, and that's where his entire legacy comes from.
Wow.
And now you could listen to him on Spotify, which is kind of crazy. Robert Johnson.
Yeah, and you can probably listen to his whole catalog in an hour and a half.
Yeah. Robert Johnson died on August 16th, 1938, at the age of 27, near Greenwood, Mississippi. It is not known what was the actual cause of death. It was not reported publicly. Nearly three decades later, Mississippi-based musicologist Gail Dean Wardlow found Johnson's death certificate, but discovered it had only listed the date and location without any cause of death, and no autopsy had been done. Some have speculated that Johnson had congenital syphilis, which could have been a contributing factor to his death. I don't know if they thought this because he showed symptoms or he was just a fuckboy, but that was one theory. But others, including a lot of scholars, a lot of people interviewed from Robert Johnson's family or people who knew him, thought that his end actually came from more nefarious means.
Well, that was the first thought I had, was honestly that it is very suspicious that a 27-year-old dies, there's no autopsy, and no inquest.
Well, no even cause of death listed, which is seems unusual. I mean, I'm sure bookkeeping wasn't exactly top of the block back in the 30s, but it seems very unusual to me.
And it wouldn't surprise me if the authorities cared less about Robert Johnson than they would have cared about maybe a white person who died.
Well, I'm sure that's the case, even if it had nothing to do with his death certificate. As detailed in the film The Search for Robert Johnson, there are a few differing accounts of the events preceding the musician's death. Johnson had been performing for the last few weeks of his life at a country dance at a town about 15 miles outside of Greenwood, Mississippi.
It's a long dance. Wasn't everybody tired after 3 weeks?
Whew, it's like the dancing plague we talked about. According to one theory, Johnson was murdered by the jealous husband of a woman who he'd been flirting with. In an account that's kind of related to this, and this was shared directly by blues musician Sonny Boy Williamson, Johnson had been flirting with this married woman at the dance, and the woman gave Robert a bottle of whiskey that, unbeknownst to Johnson, had been poisoned by her irate husband.
Did she know in this story? I'm assuming this is fake.
Maybe?
Because we don't have a name of the woman, or...
Well, she might have just been some random, but Sonny Boy Williamson was there, like, present for this, and he said this happened, so...
Okay.
Again, I mean, a lot of these guys are building their own legends, so who's to say, but it is worth noting that Johnson's own family did think he was murdered.
Now, if we're taking that guy at his word, though, what that suggests to me is that Robert Johnson drank a bottle of whiskey and then died.
Well, Robert took the bottle to drink, and Williamson knocked it from his hand, berating him to never drink from a bottle that he hadn't personally opened himself. Johnson, in response, maybe a little pissed about losing a bottle of whiskey, said, "Don't ever knock a bottle out of my hand." Soon after, Johnson was offered yet another bottle by the same lady, also had been poisoned, and this time he accepted it and drank from it.
It's just that this presupposes a world where people are just carrying around poison, and the best way to murder someone is buying them multiple bottles at the bar?
It was a thing at the time. We'll talk about it in a minute, but people were poisoned in such a fashion in this era.
Bottle service is expensive. It's just an expensive poisoning.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, how do I ensure this person's going to consume it? I'm going to give them something that looks too good to be true. A free bottle of whiskey? Hell yeah. Johnson is reported to have begun feeling sick that evening, having to help be helped back to his room in the early hours of the morning. And over the next 3 days, his condition steadily worsened, with witnesses reporting that Johnson died in a convulsive state of intense pain after vomiting, throwing up blood, having seizures, things like that. Robert McCormick claimed to have tracked down the man who supposedly had actually murdered Johnson and even obtained a confession from him in an interview, which he talked about in the Search for Robert Johnson documentary, but he wouldn't reveal the man's identity.
That's
this
weird.
Is a historian, so I don't know.
Why?
I don't know.
Because he had to promise him to get the name out of him, and
maybe.
He's an honorable dude.
Maybe. Maybe the most important thing to him was the truth and not necessarily the details being shared publicly. I don't know. But the guy's got a Wikipedia page. He is a respected music historian. So I thought it was worth mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
Some have speculated that the poison that killed Johnson was strychnine, but it's been disputed because apparently, I wouldn't know, but it has such a distinctive smell and flavor that it can't be disguised even with strong liquor.
Interesting.
But another theory, and the one that more people have seemed to gravitate to, is that Johnson was poisoned with naphthalene that is obtained from dissolved mothballs. And as you kind of queried, Sean, this was an apparently common way of poisoning people in the rural South, and it was rarely fatal. So perhaps the poisoning and this fashion of poisoning had been meant as simply sort of an uncomfortable punishment for flirting with a married woman. You know, the sort of like, I'll put Nair in her shampoo sort of vibe.
Yeah, but she agreed to do it. She was complicit in the poisoning twice?
Yeah, but maybe she didn't think that he was going to get murdered. Just that he would like have the shits really bad for a night, you know?
Yeah, well, count your mothballs more carefully.
But the thing is here that Johnson had previously been diagnosed with an ulcer and other stomach issues. So this could have resulted in hemorrhaging when introduced to this kind of poison. So his existing medical situation might have made it much more severe than it was meant to be.
Now, if we're taking that step anyway, Carrie, why not say that the existing medical condition was the only thing?
Because I don't think it was. I mean, I guess most people don't die from an ulcer. I don't know. But some people have also speculated that he had Marfan syndrome because he had like super long fingers and like large eyes. And apparently those are markers of this syndrome. And that's possibly why he was able to play so skillfully on the guitar, because he had these like long freakish fingers.
Interesting. But then that causes like a glandular.
They said that it could have led to an aortic dissection or something with the heart. So you might have had an enlarged heart if he had enlarged fingers and eyes and things like that. And he had, you know, no way to get out of it, I guess.
Yeah. So do you like the poison theory? Are there more theories?
No. I mean, from what I can tell, murder by poison does seem to be the consensus opinion for Robert Johnson's cause of death, especially by scholars and people who knew him. So, of course, this leads to speculation that he had perhaps been cursed by his pact with the devil to receive his early and violent end. Sort of like the genie thing of like, oh, I'll give you fame, but you're only going to experience it for like a year, and then you're going to die tragically. The end.
I think it's more, if it was a jealous husband who poisoned him, it's more just a, you know, an unfortunate result of
fuckboyism.
Yeah, what it sounds like Robert got up to a lot of it. I'm not slut shaming him. That's
no,
fine.
No. People gotta eat, you know what I mean?
Eat ain't cheap.
But the end of Robert Johnson is the likely beginning of the famous.
That was Bill Clinton saying.
Yeah, I know. I just started skim right over that one. This is likely the beginning of the famous 27 Club legend, which we'll certainly go into more detail down the line. But I really thought, as sort of the OG, Mr. Johnson deserved his own episode, because he kind of has this interesting legend, and then he also has this mysterious death and a very mysterious life. So, yeah, it was worth covering. But in case our listeners don't know, the 27 Club is this informal list of famous folks, mostly musicians, artists, actors, and other celebrities who have all died an untimely death at the age of 27. And there are some, I mean, there are big names. That's why it's such a thing. The most famous 27 Club members include Kurt Cobain, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Amy Winehouse, Jim Morrison, and so many others. There's even been speculation that maybe there's like a statistical possibility you might die more often at 27 when you're famous and things like that. And we'll talk about it eventually because it's an interesting little urban legend. But Robert Johnson is usually pointed to as like the first major name on this list. And some have speculated that some sort of curse follows these doomed artists. So maybe, just maybe, the roots of the curse begins in a fateful pact made at a crossroads by a desperate aspiring musician one dark Mississippi night.
I don't think that's very likely, but I loved this story. This is great.
Yeah, I always love talking music history, and there's a lot of weirdness in it. So, Robert Johnson. Anyone out there with, you know, Apple Music, Spotify, whatever, even YouTube, go listen to a few of his songs, even if you didn't necessarily dig what we played for you today. They were just hugely influential. So if you like the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, Eric Clapton, like anyone who's played a rock guitar, they were probably inspired in some fashion by Robert Johnson. So it's always worth sort of, you know, giving respect where it's due in these sorts of cases.
Yeah, and if you like what you hear, if you want to get a little of that going for yourself, just head on down to the crossroads.
But, you know, just keep going after that. Don't make any pacts with the devil.
Twenty-four hours ago, I found out the person that I'd been dating and seeing for the last 6 months as a con man.
That is my sister Emma. Andrew Tonks' lies had been so convincing, she'd invested $300,000 with him. However, the tables were about to turn on Andrew. What he didn't know was that Emma had discovered his real identity. But to get any chance of justice, Emma had to act like it was business as usual. Coming up in this series,
and that's when murder, all this stuff goes through my mind. I'm really, really scared.
I'm assuming Sarah has watched too much Netflix and figures I've been defrauding you. Couldn't be further from the truth.
That's what this was, a real life story that seems so unbelievable, but it was actually true.
A true story that all starts with one simple swipe to the right. I'm Sarah Ferris.
And I'm Emma Ferris. And this is my story, Conning the Con.
It's time to meet the weirdo of the week. And this time around, we have the mysterious pepperoni prankster.
Wait, what? Pepperoni prankster? No.
You can't
do that mid-sip.
This meatstery occurred on Wednesday of last week when Heather Doherty of Manville, New Jersey, woke up to a very strange situation at her home where she has lived for the last 16 years. Upon opening her front door, Doherty saw that her property had been covered with slices of, well, pepperoni.
Right. What do you prefer, slices or logs? I think I'd rather you just throw the whole logs down there. It's going to be less of a mess.
Well, here's what's most interesting, Saran. From what I could tell from my keen eye of observation, this looked to be from a log, hand cut. None of this pre-sliced situation. So someone put in some real effort into cutting up this pepperoni and throwing it around her lawn.
Now, that is the disturbing part of this, is picturing someone with a knife mm-hmm. just furiously chopping a pepperoni.
Because I definitely saw some butts of the pepperoni there. So it feels like they didn't just, you know, open a Hormel's or whatever and toss it around.
They're throwing coolies in there?
There's a few coolies. I saw some. I swear. The unknown prankster had left the lunch meat, quote, from the door to the edge of the porch and then strategically placed down the stairs to the driveway and four slices on the hood and four slices on the trunk of her car. So is this like an Illuminati thing? The pepperoni Illuminati, you know, Who knows? Doherty told Pix 11 local news that her house had never before been vandalized in the nearly two decades she's lived on South Street.
Okay, it still hasn't, to be fair.
Not even on Mischief Night. But now, quote, we're trying to figure out who goes around with two loaves of pepperoni. in the middle of the night and cuts it up into slices and throws it on people's property, said Doherty. You have nothing better to do with your time? Doherty reported the strange situation to the police, though it's hard to say whether an actual crime has occurred here. More than anything, it's just, you know, weird. Doing the real work of the people, as local journalists always do, Pix 11 sought out a local body shop to see if pepperoni being applied to car paint could ruin a vehicle's exterior.
Were the slices on her car as well?
Yes, four on the front, four on the back.
Oh.
Pepperoni cannot damage car paint if it doesn't sit for a really long time, said Ricardo Ludena of Gifford Auto Body. It can damage it if it's sitting around, especially on a hot day. Leaving no slice uncut, Pix 11 also contacted their local pepperoni experts for their take on the strange situation. Quote,
It's just our friends Bob and Jim.
Spending a lifetime in the business of pepperoni, the owner of Manville Pizza, Anthony Danello, says the meat looks larger than the kind you would use on pizza. Quote, certainly, of the family of pepperoni, maybe salami, exactly what I cannot be certain, said Danello. As an Italian, it hurts the heart. Which is true. Two loaves of pepperoni wasted.
It's a horrible waste.
And you don't know what it even means.
He said, as an Italian, it hurts the heart.
As an Italian, it hurts the heart.
Listen,
and honestly, I feel that deeply in my core.
Having eaten a lot of pepperoni in my life, I think it has had an impact on my heart.
Mm-hmm. If not your car paint.
Also, that is that is exactly what local news is for. That's amazing coverage.
Two experts? I mean, incredible work. For Doherty's part, she just wants some answers. It is funny, however, it's wrong, she said. You should not be trespassing, you should not be vandalizing people's properties. And as of recording, chillingly, the pepperoni prankster remains at large.
Dun, dun, dun. Have there been further sausagings?
Not as far as I could tell. There was a follow-up with Doherty, who said that she was recognized multiple times while at her local grocery store after the news story broke.
Yeah, but only in the cured meats aisle.
But no more mysterious meats have turned up. But I will definitely keep an eye on this situation and make sure to let our listeners know if the pepperoni prankster strikes again.
Thank you, Carrie. You're doing God's work out there.
I know. Someone has to. That's it for this episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ain't It Scary, and check out our website at ain'titscary.com. You can support the show by supporting our sponsors and becoming a patron at www.patreon.com/ain'titscary. You can call us and leave a message at our Google Voice number, 203-666-5529. And please subscribe to the show and throw us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and also on Spotify. We'll be forever grateful.
We certainly will. And special thanks to those of you already joining us on those top couple of Patreon tiers. Sean O'Donnell, Jared Chamberlain, Maria Ferrante, Robin McCabe, Comfy Mike, Alex Nakutis, Ryan Regan, Christy Atchison, Kate Pope, Haley, Ryan, Enrique, Ira, Pete, Anna, Delaney, and Sue. Thank you all very much. We love you. And it's been a while since I reminded you, you're still members of our spooky family.
See you next Thursday.
Show created by Sean and Carrie McCabe. Music by Kyle Ryan. You can find Kyle at his YouTube channel, Music is a Verb.
Ain't It Scary has been brought to you by Killer Podcasts and is a production of Longboy Media.
I'm Richard Serrett. Join me on Strange Planet for in-depth conversations with the world's top paranormal investigators, alien abductees, Bigfoot trackers, monster hunters, time travelers, alternative archaeologists, remote viewers, and more.
As I was on the way to Area 51, I was stopping on the side of the road and just taking measurements, and I found this one spot where time slowed down by a fraction of a second. It's not supposed to do that.
From the two big categories, animal mutilations and human abductions, you have to conclude that genetic material is being harvested.
Well, I reached for a rifle, and I turned and looked, and it was already moving away, and it was descending the bluff. There's no way any human could have went down it. It was probably a 75-degree angle straight down, almost.
On Richard Serrett's Strange Planet, we're redefining reality. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
do not go any further. Turn around, go home.